put them in a beautiful environment where they're given everything that they need. I think there were around like 100 mice. They put them in this place. They all had food, water, shelter, everything that they needed. And day by day, that society of mice just degraded and degraded and degraded. And it got to a point where mothers were eating their children as soon as they were born. There were certain groups of those mice which were just the pretty ones, and they would just groom themselves and had no function in the society except to look very good for others, and that's it. So, and then eventually this society of mice started to kill each other. It would have just ended in suicide, mass suicide. It's so bizarre. Please go and look at it, because it's really eye-opening.
Yeah.
And it's one of those fantastic experiments that it actually lets you have a look at what humans can become. Humans can become way worse than that.
So you said that why they started killing each other?
That's the strange thing about it, because they were pretty much given everything that they needed. And there were lots of factors that it comes down to. But the point is that they had everything given to them. Usually you would have to struggle. You're in the wild and you have to find your food, you know, run away from cats. They had none of that. Everything's happy. Everything is the way that it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
See, even when I said that, it gave you like a uncanny feeling, like it's not supposed to be that way.
Exactly.
There's lots of things to look into.
Same thing happens to people. There's another point also. An ideal mind is the devil's workplace. Like, I guess when you do not have anything to engage yourself with, when you do not have a greater cause to fight for, when you do not have a purpose for your life, when, I don't know, all of causes like this, if you do not have them, then you would feel your life as an empty process.
Yes, in a materialistic world, you know, we are losing our own self, like we are losing our self-awareness, self-esteem and self-confidence over the price of just having a lot of things around us and just being... trusting those things. We are trusting our life around. We are trusting the things that we have. We are being proud of, I don't know, our cars, our homes.
Yeah, pinning our hopes on things that are not going to last.
And we lose
forever.
Ourselves, and we are not even aware. Like, I'm losing my self-esteem or this price. Is it worth?
And we're not aware of the break.
Yeah, and
so we have to go for a break. Welcome back. Well, still you're listening to Back to Reality. This is the last part of today's episode. We're talking about why us in today's world, when we have everything, seemingly actually, we have everything, there's a lot of people who tend to kill themselves and end this life, though they must actually appreciate it.
You mentioned a very good point before going to the break, and it's about procrastination and distracting yourself. I mean, we're all students of language and literature here.
Yeah.
So are you guys procrastinators at all? Do you procrastinate?
Yes, unfortunately. I do it a lot.
Yeah, I do it a lot as well.
Yeah.
I think it might be because our faculty of imagination is very overbearing, and you have these creative bursts and you can suddenly start researching about, I don't know, baby otters or something, or platypus.
Yeah, at the time when you don't have to.
Yeah.
At the time when you have something more important to do, you go for other stuff. Suddenly my mind tends to be more creative.
It was when my exams were looming, and every time my exams are looming, I can start writing the best literature and stories for children and start
just painting
pictures.
Just when you said the time of exam, I knew what you're going to say.
It's interesting at that
time. All right, okay, okay. And that's when it's most pleasurable. Because when I hit the holidays, I don't feel like doing anything.
Very true.
Okay?
Yeah.
Is that? Okay,
yeah,
thank you. Okay, so I'm not alone on that.
Yeah.
We know that we're supposed to be doing something, studying for our exams.
Yes.
And that's what makes the pleasure of not doing it so much greater, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now imagine you know your purpose in life is to worship Allah. And that's why life is so enjoyable, right? Because we're constantly distracting ourselves from our Lord. We're watching TV or videos, or we're reading, whatever we're doing, we're distracting ourselves. Imagine if you didn't have that purpose. to worship Allah in the first place?
Yeah.
Would it still be pleasurable, the dunya?
No.
No.
That's what they're living in. Do you understand?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
hell. Why would you not commit suicide?
The problem is, even when they get too much of life, just right then they come to realize that, okay, I did not have that thing, that other purpose that was the very important purpose in my life, but I'm just losing it. Mm. I'm missing it. My life is missing something very important.
It's
without
like they come to the end.
Knowing it.
It's like they imagine, okay, it's the end. Mm-hmm. I have everything. Why should I leave? What should I work for? Why mm-hmm. should I tolerate this world?
Exactly.
And it's like it's done for them. And mm-hmm. that moment they think of committing suicide.
So the thing that makes the game pretty much different is the idea of worship, of believing that you have a connection to your Lord. You have submission. And you have to act according to whatever he wants you to. You have a purpose in this life, and that purpose is to be a good human being, just as God has asked you to be. And without this, pretty naturally, life is just going to be a materialistic thing that is going to lose its taste. If we keep going, we would have a lot of other points, but then this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
In the limelight.
Shortly before midnight on Sunday, 14th of April, the Islamic Republic of Iran launched a swarm of drones and missiles at the occupied Palestinian territories in response to the Zionist regime's cowardly airstrike on Iran's consulate building in Damascus, Syria, on 1st of April. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Iran's retaliation against the Israeli attack on its consulate building in Damascus, Syria was not totally unexpected. However, the meticulous planning and massive scale of the attack marked a watershed moment and the beginning of the end of the occupying Israeli regime. A powerful message was delivered through a barrage of missiles and drones fired at midnight from different Iranian cities, which sent shockwaves in the power corridors of Tel Aviv. The Iranian Armed Forces first launched the Shahed-131 and the Shahed-136 type drones, widely filmed as they flew over Iraq. These drones needed about 6 hours to reach their target. About 4 hours after the Shahed-131 and Shahed-136 drones were fired, Iran's Parveh land attack cruise missiles were also launched for simultaneous landing in the occupied Palestinian lands. Both types of weapons represent the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Aerospace Force's lowest-cost, long-range strike assets. Their task in this operation was to force the enemy to spend its resources on them, committing its air power and spending significant more expensive air-to-air missiles to intercept them. Here, the higher speed of cruise missiles and their unknown quantity forced Israeli, British, Jordanian, and potentially French fighter jets to use air-to-air missiles instead of guns to save time. the cost ratio between the assets that Iran committed to the operation and the Israeli regime required to counter it was massive. Israel's fear of its GPS jamming not working against drones and cruise missiles led to the costly decision of intercepting them kinetically. 5 to 10 minutes before the surviving drones and cruise missiles were to reach their intended targets in the occupied Palestinian territories, Iran launched the main weapons of the True Promise operation. The ballistic missiles were not launched simultaneously on purpose to reduce the shock effect on Israel's missile defenses. Surviving drones and cruise missiles put additional stress on the radars and sensors, creating completely different targets at lower altitudes. These involved ballistic missiles Emad, Qad, Desful, and Khaybar Shekan. The quantity of the launch missiles remains unknown and could range between 60 and 120. Descending from space like meteors, Qad and Emad ballistic missiles would have first faced Israel's Arrow 3 missile interceptors, as well as the US SM-3. Those older Iranian missiles mainly defend themselves with inflatable decoys in space. The expensive and advanced American ANTPY-2 could have helped Israel's missile defenders to identify which objects were warheads, which empty spent boosters, and which were decoys. The 20-year-old Qad missile may have created confusion for the radars, as well as guaranteeing their survivability by releasing submunition payload while still in space. In the chaos of ballistic missiles' re-entry vehicle housing the warhead, spent booster stages and submunitions released by Qad and Emad missiles would also have released their decoys to survive against Arrow 3 and SM-3. Once Emad missile's re-entry vehicle enters the atmosphere, they can start to maneuver and alter their trajectory. This is done to increase precision and to perform random evasive maneuvering. Since Israel can't launch an interceptor for each of the several submunitions of Qad, those inaccurate warheads are immune to the interceptors. However, Emad would rely on a short atmospheric flight time enabled by a steep dive trajectory plus random evasive maneuvering. Arrow 2, Patriot and David Sling are the systems that tried to intercept and maneuvering Emad's re-entry vehicles. Emad missiles were also fast and glowing objects descending and impacting at 6 to 7 times the speed of sound. The slow glowing objects seem to be the submunitions of Qad, and the slow objects in flame were likely to be separated empty booster stages. Another missile, Desful, was apparently launched against Israeli targets in the occupied Golan Heights. The Desful missile is limited to the northeast part of the occupied Palestinian territories by its maximum range and can exploit the distance to Israeli missile defense barriers to perform its mission at Israel's periphery. No information about those strikes is available, but the low-cost Desful missile would avoid coming within Arrow 3 range by flying a relatively low trajectory. To counter endo-atmospheric interceptors like Arrow 2, Patriot and David Sling's Stunner, it would randomly maneuver similar to Emad missile. The most advanced ballistic missile known to have been used in the operation is the Khaybar Shekan. This missile completely avoids Arrow 3 and SM-3 interceptors by flying inside the very upper layers of the atmosphere. Once close to the Arrow 2, Patriot and David Sling, it further descends to engage with the Earth's atmosphere to begin random evasive maneuvering by its fins. Khaybar Shekan performs this maneuvering in the upper atmosphere layers, and once it has slowed down to a certain threshold speed, it dives down at a steep angle. Since it depends on the selected trajectory, its impact speed can be 5 times the speed of sound, combined with prior maneuvering. Some classify it as Iran's first hypersonic missile. Khaybar Shekhan and Ahmad are candidates for some of the very clear impacts, foremost at least 5 successive hits seen in one of the videos. Other missiles that might have participated are the Rezwan and the Haj Qasem, but no cleared launch or spent booster footage of those has appeared as of now. The targets were Israeli air bases, which represent difficult, highly protected, high-value assets of the Israeli regime. This target would not be a completely disproportionate response, achieve the retaliation objective, and display Iran's missile capabilities to Israel for strategic reasons. Website Axios has also covered the same story and tells us more. Israel in the past often responded disproportionately against others due to its military might. Its ballistic missile defense protected its critical military sites against ballistic missiles, and its air force and defense systems, like the Iron Dome, countered air-breathing threats like bomber aircraft. In that sense, it felt a high level of safety against any external attack, attracting multi-billion dollar investments for technology giants like Intel. Israel's overmatch in capability allowed for such fragile industries to come to the conflict region. The inability to protect a critical high-value object, like the Nevatim airbase, means Iran has the capability to repeat such a salvo against any object in the occupied Palestinian territories. Iran already displayed the accuracy and destructive power of its ballistic missiles in the salvo against the Ain al-Assad airbase, a US military base in Iraq, which was a soft target. Hence, independent of the damage caused, which had to be limited to resemble a proportional response in some way, Iran displayed the capability very clearly and strongly. From the limited information available on the targets that were hit in the occupied Palestinian territories, we see that taxiway sections and aprons were hit in a systematic manner. This is what someone would do if it doesn't want to cause heavy financial damage and keep the response near proportional. There is still only limited information about what was hit at the Nevatim airbase or even the Ramon airbase in the occupied Golan Heights amid a complete information blackout imposed by the Israeli regime. Another key aspect of the operation was the effort Iran forced upon the regime involving aircraft and its operation costs to counter drones and cruise missiles with air-to-air missiles. Only Israel clearly knows how many interceptors were spent in the observed ripple launchers. Only Israel knows about the reserves it has of these several times more expensive counters to the threat. Only Israel knows how well each of the systems, the Arrow 3 and the Arrow 2, the Patriot and David Sling, performed and which regions they cover at what quality.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Farewell to the arms.
Part 1.
The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But some time later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. 6 months passed since the final declaration of the United Nations, but normalcy had yet to be restored to the cities. The people of Palestine did not want to come to terms with the injustice. Everyone knew that the war was looming. People in Deir Yassin were seeing the migrant Jews in their neighborhoods. They didn't want to be the initiators of war. They were preparing for a new harvest season. But the sun had just risen when 120 Israeli armed men surrounded the village. The people of Deir Yassin faced what they had feared most. Deir Yassin was the first place to burn in the flames of war. The stench of major atrocity filled the air in Palestine. The Israelis killed more than 250 civilians, including women and children, and over 100 children were left orphans. Other cities and villages faced Deir Yassin's fate one after the other. Palestinian men sent their families to safer cities and took up arms to defend their homeland. After a few months of popular resistance, the armies of Arab nations rushed to the Palestinian people's rescue, which led to the first Arab-Israeli war. year later, Israelis were the winners of the war. The 65,000 strong army that had come from 7 Arab states to help the Palestinians could not do much. They were less than half the Israeli forces in numbers. On the other hand, the Israelis' newly purchased equipment, compared to the Palestinians' old and dilapidated equipment, made many people disappointed. The immigrant Jews, who had only purchased only 2% of Palestine's land from the British, were now occupying 70% of the land. The war claimed the lives of 25,000 people and left 700,000 Palestinians homeless and displaced. They migrated to neighboring countries. People lived cold and grim lives away from home. Their only hope was to return to their homes one day. After a few years, a new ray of hope shines for the Palestinians. This time from the West, a man came to power in Egypt. People are infatuated with his ideas. His words smell like freedom. Gamal Abdel Nasser's ideas are an inspiration for nations seeking independence. He sought to revive the pride of Arab nations. He forced thousands of European troops who've been occupying Egypt for decades to pack up and leave for Britain. The people were filled with joy. Gamal had an idea. He wants to unite Arab nations so they can gain independence together. But there's a major obstacle in his path.
About the rights of the Arabs of Palestine were expelled out of their country. We have about 1.5 million refugees. They treated the Arabs the same way. Expelled them, killed their children, destroyed their villages, and there was escape from Palestine to the Arab country. The Arab of Palestine want to return back to their homeland.
The Israeli army decided to conquer the entire Middle East. Their military equipment is made up of the most modern French warships and warplanes, and the United States is also beefing up their military by handing them more than $60 million in military aid each year. But worst of all was the news of atomic weapons being produced in Israel's nuclear sites. It meant that the Israelis were not going to give up so easily. Gamal had initiated various projects to empower Egypt on par with Israel and was now holding war games so he can flaunt his country's military might to world leaders. The flames of the war would either burn Israel or it would shatter Gamal's dreams. Tensions were on the rise along the borders. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. The Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As a next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. Gamal's nightmare came true. Israel strikes preemptively and turns the tide in its own favor. Israeli jets destroyed more than 400 Egyptian aircraft and their hangars. The Jordanian army orders a counter-strike in revenge, but the Jordanian fighter jets disappear from radar screens one after the next. The outcome of the battle on the ground was not so different from the one in the air. Once again, people had to flee in order to save their own lives. Israel only needed 6 days to grab enough land to make itself three times larger. Syria's Golan Heights, southern Lebanon, the Sinai Desert in Egypt, and all of Palestine up to the River Jordan were occupied by Israel. Other Arab nations ended up with the same fate as the Palestinians had. Now half the population of Palestine had to live under Israeli occupation. It seems they had to give up their struggle for freedom. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of two Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. But they were ambushed and surrounded from behind. They were trapped and in the first few hours suffered over 100 casualties. Israeli forces received a lethal blow, so they retreated. The Jordanian artillery also rushed to the rescue of Fatah and struck the retreating Israeli forces. Now, all that remained from the so-called invincible army was a few abandoned, burned-out tanks. Fatah broke the myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army. The leader of their group was one of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who did something astounding to achieve his goals. The man who always had a smile on his face and would never give up. In August 1929, the sixth child of the Arafat family was born. His father named him Mohammed Yasser, meaning the bringer of relief, to give hope to the family in hardships. His Palestinian family had migrated from Al-Quds to Egypt a few years back, but the hard times came to him sooner than he expected. He lost his mother when he was just 4 years old and laid her to rest. And his father had to send him to live with his uncle in Al-Quds. Yasser witnesses the conflict between Palestinian freedom fighters and British forces in Al-Quds up close and personal. After a while, he goes back to Cairo to study. His first year at the university coincides with the hard days for Palestine and the start of the first Arab-Israeli war. He joined the Arab nation's army to go fight for Palestine. However, after a year, they suffered a defeat and he thought he should perhaps pursue his studies. He applies for a visa to study at the University of Texas in the U.S. It took a few months for his request to be processed. Yasser, meanwhile, changed his mind and decided to stay and fight to return to his homeland. At first, he held discussions and forums about Palestine. In one of these discussions, he revealed his plans. He asserted that armed resistance was the only way to save Palestine and founded the Fatah movement. He planned a series of operations, but everything should have been done secretly. But the second defeat for the Arab nations was a heavy blow for him. This time around, he planned an operation in the heart of Tel Aviv and immediately claimed responsibility for it. When he was asked to retreat, he responded, "The Palestinian people have always been fleeing, but this time we are going to resist, even if it costs us our lives." Only 48 hours after Arafat's victory, 5,000 people asked to join the Fatah movement. Arafat's popularity grew by the day, so Israelis decided to immediately take him out. Arafat became so popular that everyone called him leader of the Palestinian nation. They said, "He's come to shine the ray of hope in the heart of the Palestinian nation." Fatah grew bigger and bigger by the day. After a year, the Arab nations recognized Fatah as the only official Palestinian organization. Gamal, as the most important Arab leader, also backed it. The Fatah movement's successes aroused the Jordanian king's jealousy. And in no time, a conflict started between Fatah and the Jordanian army. Gamal acted as a mediator and asked both sides to stop fighting. Arafat agreed, but the next day, Gamal said farewell to life after a heart attack, and Arafat, who had just set out in this path, lost his important supporter. Arafat was forced to relocate the Fatah movement's headquarters. Lebanon was the first destination that Arafat chose to continue his fight against Israel. Although he had many opponents in Lebanon, his backers give him and this cause all-out support. Yet Arafat did not believe that Lebanon's support for the liberation of Palestine was enough. Arafat's trips around the world made headline news. He embarked on trips from Asia to Africa and from Africa to Europe to find new supporters. Only a few days after victory of the Iranian Revolution, he traveled to Iran and the first Palestinian embassy was established in Tehran in his presence. People in occupied Palestinian territories knew Arafat very well. He wanted to get the world on board in order to wrest back the occupied Palestinian territories and soon got what he was looking for. He traveled to New York and for the first time, a Palestinian speaks about Palestine to world leaders for an hour. And everyone gave him a standing ovation. Everyone but one group.
بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانه ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. Inshallah, today we will talk about Ayah 48 of Surah An-Nisa on page 86. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, open your Quran the same as Ali Nasir and Fawad here. Hold it in front of you. Turn to page 86. Ayah 48 of Surah An-Nisa. 1, 2, 3. Let's listen.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna Allah la yaghfiru an yushraka bih wa yaghfiru ma dun dhalika liman yasha wa man yushrik billahi faqad iftara ithman 'azima.
Good job. Nice one. Nice recitation. This ayah is an important ayah, okay? Let's say what Allah made, he says in this ayah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna Allah la yaghfiru an yushraka bihi wa yaghfiru ma dun dhalika liman yasha. وَمَن يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ فَقَدِ افْتَرَى إِثْمًا عَظِيمًا.
Very important ayah. Tells us about one of the greatest sins, okay? Alright? Look, Allah Almighty says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ إِنَّ, like, is an emphatic word. Emphatic word, okay? It emphasizes. لا يغفر أن يشرك به. Indeed, Allah Almighty, for sure, Allah Almighty does not forgive that any partner should be ascribed to him. Does not forgive this kind of sin. What sin? That any partner should be ascribed to him. What? Allah Almighty, or in creation, I believe, okay, that, well, Allah Almighty really did not create the world. It was all of a sudden automatic. Big bang. That's all. No Allah. If somebody thinks this way, believes this way, in the day of judgment, Allah Almighty will not forget.
So this is a kind of shirk or
yeah,
not?
Shirk. Of course, shirk.
Shirk.
No, because it is denying the existence. So,
yeah.
Shirk.
Look, shirk also does not only mean like you count partners. So look, if you're saying automatic, okay, it's something automatic, okay? Like the universe automatically has happened, okay, this way. It means that you never believe in God. You think like something else has done the creation. Yeah? While we believe that Allah Almighty has done the creation, not anybody else, not automatic
this
things.
This is shirk and khaliqiyat?
Yeah, shirk and khaliqiyat. The main point about shirk and khaliqiyat is this, that you believe that somebody else has done it. For example, what? For example, you create something, okay? You create something. You design, for example, a platform or whatever, okay? Design a mobile phone. You think, oh, I'm the creator. It's not God. While Allah Almighty, in fact, is the creator. Because Allah Almighty created the first materials, yes?
Yeah.
The basic materials. You just put them together. Don't be proud of yourself like you made a mobile phone. Come on. Right? If you are that smart, create the very basic things. The iron itself, create it. How do you create? What do? Go to the mountains. Yeah? Undergrounds. Search for iron. Ah, Allah Almighty has put them there. Okay? Don't think like you have done it. No way. Tawheed, for example, in tawassul, we have. Tawheed and, for example, ownership, we have. Tawheed and, for example, what? In what? We have? Ibadah, we have.
Yeah.
Ibadah, we have. You worship, for God forbid, somebody else. For money, you worship. Yeah? So this kind of shirk, God forbid, okay? If you don't believe in tawheed, instead you believe in shirk, this is called what? Ithman azima. Allah Almighty will not forgive this. Now, وَمَن يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ, and whoever ascribes partners to Allah Almighty, فَقَدْ افْتَرَى إِثْمًا عَظِيمًا, has indeed fabricated a lie, إِثْمًا عَظِيمًا, in great sinfulness, okay? Has fabricated in great sinfulness. Now, Allah Almighty might, it's also depends to Allah Almighty, okay? That whether He forgives somebody in other kind of sins, okay, or not. But sins which is shirk, Allah Almighty will not forgive it. Inna Allah la yaghfiru. La yaghfiru, look, yaghfiru, the word, the form of word, okay, based on Arabic grammar, it is mudari'a. Mudari'a. And mudari'a talks about continuous things, something which is continuous. So la yaghfiru means continuous. It's continuous. Allah Almighty
will not forgive.
Ah, does not forgive. It does not mean that Allah Almighty did not forgive for that person and He will give for this person. No. La yaghfiru. Ayyushraka bihi, whoever it is, no matter it is a girl, a boy, a man, a woman, okay? He is a scholar or a normal person. He's a doctor, he got a PhD, he got a master's, whatever, okay? Anybody. That's all.
قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي.
How to learn Quran easy? What is the correct way to read the Quran? What is the correct way to learn Arabic and understand the Quran?
آيات الله حمتني غمرتني بالبركات تحفظني من همزات الشيطان ومن زلات.
Be with Let's Recite the Quran.
غمرتني بالبركات تحفظني من همزات الشيطان ومن زلات. قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي.
Refer to the Tafasir books, inshallah, especially theology books, okay, about Tawheed. There are a lot of books written, okay, about Tawheed, about Usuluddin, okay, Usul Aqaidina. So you can refer to them and learn more, inshallah. Let's mention the important Tajweed rules in this ayah, and then inshallah we'll end up our session with a recitation. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَغْفِرُ أَن يُشْرَكَ بِهِ. إِنَّ نُون مُشَدَّد we got, right?
Yeah.
So yes. When you have نُون مُشَدَّد, you what?
You produce a nasal sound.
Nasal sound plus?
And extend the sound for two beats. All right,
master. Master of Tajweed, mashallah. So you extend the sound for two beats and you what? Produce a nasal sound. إِنَّ. Then when you read the word Allah, Whenever, Ali Nasir, you have to tell us. Whenever we see the word Allah, we have to look at the letter?
Before.
The vowel with the letter before.
Yeah.
So, if the letter before the word Allah, it carries a fatha or a dhamma on the top, the word Allah is pronounced how?
Heavily.
Inna Allaha, la. What if it carries a kasra below it?
Lightly.
Bismillahi min 'indillahi. This way. Yes? Kasra. So, that's it about the word Allah. La yaghfiru an yushraka bihi. For sure, Fawad has to tell us this rule. An yushraka. What rule is there? Look, I'm reading it this way. The correct reading is this way. I just omitted the noon. What yes, happened sir. To it?
After the noon sakin, there's the letter ya.
Mm-hmm.
Ya is in the group of yirmanun letters,
mm-hmm.
which are the letters of the group of idgham,
mm-hmm.
which basically means merging
mm-hmm.
the letter noon sakin or tanween
into the next letter.
All right. And omitting the noon or tanween. All right,
good job. Because you merge it, it's just disappears.
Yeah, it's omitted.
So we have to produce a nasal sound also. Added, okay? Nasal sound. And also what? I didn't answer. Extended for?
Two bits.
Actually, for four of the letters. Yeah, wow, meme, noon. Not for ra and lam.
Yes.
So, let me read it. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَغْفِرُ أَن يُشْرَكَ بِهِ right? That's it. يُشْرَكَ بِهِ. If you see there is a fallen ya down up like next to the ha.
Yes.
What does it say?
Extending the sound of all the
right, for
wow.
two beats, okay?
Yeah.
بِهِ this way.
Yeah.
أَن يُشْرَكَ بِهِ وَيَغْفِرُ The line is pronounced heavily. وَيَغْفِرُ مَا دُونَ ذَلِكَ لِمَن. Again. أَن يُشْرَكَ لِمَن يَشَاءُ. All right? So there is a jim on the top. What to do with a jim? What does it mean?
It means that you can stop.
You can stop.
Or continue.
Good job. So this is the sign of stopping. So you can stop or continue. Jim says ja'is.
Yeah.
It's okay. Optional. Again.
Noon
plus وَمَن يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ. You remember I told you that rule about Allah? We mentioned it?
Yeah.
This is now. You got a kasra before the word Allah, so pronounced with an ahsan. وَمَن يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ فَقَدِ افْتَرَى. قَا
هِي بِاللَّهِ. And Ra is heavy too.
Is also heavy letter. فَقَدِ افْتَرَى. You can extend the sound, okay? Ra for five or six counts because there is a hamza after it. But still, you can like skip it as well because it's optional. It's jais. Ithman azima. Tanween plus ayn says change nothing. Ithman azima.
Idhar.
Idhar. Clearly read the tanween sound. So, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, thank you so much for being up to this point with us. Now, the last part of our class, we will recite it, inshallah, because we've mentioned the tajweed rules. Now, you can recite beautifully with tajweed rules. So, listen and repeat with us. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
إن الله لا يغفر أن يشرك به ويغفر ما دون ذلك لمن يشاء
إن الله لا يغفر أن يشرك به ويغفر ما دون ذلك لمن يشاء
أحسنتم ما شاء الله brothers, dear reciters
وَمَنْ يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ فَقَدْ افْتَرَى إِثْمًا عَظِيمًا
وَمَنْ يُشْرِكْ بِاللَّهِ فَقَدْ افْتَرَى إِثْمًا عَظِيمًا
ماشاءاللہ صدق اللہ العلی العظیم
صدق اللہ العلی العظیم
ماشاءاللہ اللہ bless you انشاءاللہ That's all for today. Brothers and sisters, stay with IRIB English Radio, inshallah. Thank you so much, Fawad and Ali Nasir. Thanks for being with us today. Inshallah, we'll be here with you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadi wa alihi al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
IRIB English Radio
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.